Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Positive Education Podcast. My name is Ash Manuel, and I'm really excited for today's episode. But before we get into it, I just want to ask a quick favor. If you could go over to the platform that you're listening to this podcast on and give a 5-star review, particularly if you think that you get lots of value from the podcast, because what that does, it'll help us reach more people and hopefully have a positive impact on people as well. Also, we'll put in the show notes a link to the Wellbeing Wizard waiting list. Wellbeing Wizard is about to launch. It's a tool that is designed to make teaching wellbeing a lot easier and simpler for teachers in the classroom. Because as we know, there's so much that happens in a school. And one of those things that sometimes gets left behind is the wellbeing. And we made it really easy for teachers to create lessons, frameworks, policies, individual learning plans, cultural contexts, to create that wellbeing in your classrooms and also across the school. It's a fantastic tool, really happy where it's at. We're testing it at the moment and that is about to launch soon. So be sure to join the waiting list there. Now, today's episode, I'm really excited for today because our special guest is Melo Colaco. Now, Melo is a specialist in burnout. Now, preventing burnout. He's a high-performance coach, and we talk about his journey to get where he is today, but he went down the path of prevention, preventing burnout. So Melo is a TEDx speaker, an author of the book Beating Burnout and Finding Balance. Highly recommend reading that. And he works with high-flying corporates, Fortune 500 companies, professional athletes, and also educators. Now, education or teaching is one of the most stressful industries in the world because it's a care industry and people do it because they care. But as we discuss, sometimes we forget about our own self-care and that can sometimes lead to burnout. And we actually go into quite a conversation about what actually is burnout for a start. So it's important to know that. And Melo shares what it is. And also he talks about the difference between stress and burnout, which I think is really important to understand the difference as well. We also talk about how, as educators, we can support each other as a prevention, or as a preventative way of preventing burnout as well. We also talk about little tips that we can implement across our days as well. Heaps of takeaways in this. Highly recommend listening to this episode. Really loved it. I took so many things away from the episode myself. And without further ado, we'll get into it. Melo, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Mate, really excited to have you on. You're a high performance coach. You've got a lot of experience. And I think you are going to give a lot of helpful tips to teachers because I know that you work with educators, but also you work with corporates, individuals, athletes across a whole wide range of industries. And I know that the teachers who listen to this are going to take a whole lot away from our conversation today. But first of all, did you always want to become a high-performance coach?
No, it's just an evolution of my work, to be honest. And also mental health. I never imagined myself working in mental health. There's no way in the world would I choose to work in mental health, but it found me in many ways. So I followed my heart, followed my passion, followed what I do, and I've always liked helping people. I've always liked supporting people and coaching people and teaching people or mentoring in whatever capacity that was. And it actually started out more in the physical type therapy. So I was working in health, physical health, so like a personal trainer type thing, but doing a lot more chronic conditions and interesting cases often very related to mental health. So often when it's chronic pain in the body, someone might come to me with a sore knee that they can't do exercise, and then they realize that it's affecting their mental health. So then I noticed that most people that are attracted to my work through all the different areas of work that I did was more mental health related. So then I started working in psychiatric clinics, and I worked in mental health clinics for 20 plus years. I definitely cut my teeth in there. I learned the good, the bad, the ugly of the psychiatric clinic world. And I designed a program, a well-being program. It's about an 8-week program which incorporated mindfulness, exercise, and a whole range of things. It turned out to be one of the most popular programs in the psychiatric clinic, and there was a wait list for years for some of my programs. So that exploded, and I turned out doing about 80% of my work was mental health. And like I said before, I never thought I'd work in mental health. It just found me. And then I started realizing, hey, I want to help people, preventative before they end up in the clinic. So I started designing some programs, more preventative type mindfulness techniques and resilience training and a whole range of different stress relieving techniques to help people coming into those clinics. Because I realized many of those people in those clinics were very smart people, very brilliant people. They just burnt out or had poor mental health issues. Some of them were CEOs of companies. Some of them were elite athletes. Some of them were, very high performers. So then I decided to change my focus and work with high performers and preventative to provide preventative measures so they prevent coming into the clinic in the first place. So yeah, it's been an evolution of my work and it's still evolving, to be honest. It's still constantly changing. And as long as I'm helping people and supporting people, I'm happy and I've got some tools and techniques that, people resonate with and I make them very applicable and implementable. And now here I am as a high performance coach. I do, many keynote talks. I work in some of the largest companies in the world, some of the Fortune 500 companies. I work with elite athletes, Olympic athletes, a whole range of different people, work in schools, as you said, and I just love it. Absolutely love it. So it's been an evolution of my work, and I've just followed my heart along the way.
Brilliant, mate. I love that. And I love how you mentioned about the preventative. I totally agree with that. And I think that's why, well, personally, this is going back a dozen years ago now when I started growing with gratitude. I learned some skills as an adult that I found that helped me a lot with just like reflecting on things that I'm grateful for. But you mentioned physical activity. I think physical activity, in my opinion anyway, is probably the most important thing we can do for our mental health. And that's why I always talk about to kids. Like, it's great for our bodies, but it's just even better for our minds, as a preventative thing and as, also as a mood shifter. So it's really interesting. I'd love to dive into a bit more about the physical activity side of things, particularly for educators. Now, just one thing that came to mind, I was really curious. So you mentioned about the CEOs and athletes in like psychiatric, I guess, hospitals. So
Yeah, clinics and hospitals, yeah.
how, because you probably from the outside, like, we look at these CEOs, athletes, but we don't really understand, I guess, what they go through sometimes. And what takes someone to actually go into a ward or a clinic like that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Actually, in one of the clinics that I work at, there's a back door, so to speak, like a side door at the back of the car park. So, and that's a bit of a revolving door. And that back door is a bit more of a private entrance where people come in. And that could be a celebrity, for example, that's, it's in the media, or it could be an athlete in the AFL football club or whatever it is. It could be a CEO, executive, or whatever it is. And that door surprised me on how often it was swinging open and people were coming in that backside door. So mental health is not exempt to anybody, without basic fundamental self-care, first of all, because very often, a CEO or a high performer, sometimes they're their own worst enemy, where they just want to give the best, perfectionists, and they just give everything to their work. And sometimes they forget about themselves. They actually forget about their 101 fundamental self-care. There's a CEO that I was inducting not long ago into my work, into my coaching program, and I asked him some basic fundamental questions around, self-care and hobbies and interests, and he started crying. He actually realized, hey, I've just let all that go. Like, I've just totally, and it wasn't until I pointed it out that he realized that he let it go. So that's where that self-awareness piece is a big one. So, very often, and sometimes it's the purpose and the passion and the mission, they start out doing one thing and they sort of, get sent astray. But yes, you'll be surprised how many people come through those sliding back doors there of those psychiatric clinics. So that's why I wanted to design those preventative measures to in the first place.
Absolutely. I think I love that, like, self-awareness. That's one of the that's what I love self-awareness as a, I guess, a theme or a concept, whatever you want to call it, or a skill, probably even a skill. And I think that's one of the most important skills we can learn as a person, because if you're self-aware, then we can, I guess, work out those things that we need to work on for a start, and also knowing our strengths and weaknesses, being aware of how we're feeling, where we need to get help. And I think it's one of the most important skills. And for educators, it's probably I reckon it could be the number one skill we need, because we're just speaking before we hit record, and like, the stats around teachers burning out, but also leaving the industry. Like, I think it's like 50% of teachers leave the industry within their first 5 years of teaching. And if you actually go back a step, 50%, I believe, I think it's around 50% of teachers who start the degree don't actually finish. So they're probably going to the classroom and thinking, well, this isn't actually for me, which is fair enough. It's probably a few things to that. But I think teachers are always on. Like they're always on, feel emotionally drained. So I guess how can we help educators with burnout?
Yeah, and I totally agree with you. Like number one skill, actually not just for teachers, for everybody, is self-awareness. Like I always say, you can't change what you don't notice. You know, so you have to notice it first. You have to notice that, you know, you're feeling stressed. What do I do about that? And notice that you're feeling a bit anxious. What do I do about that? So number one is self-awareness. In fact, when I wrote my book, Beating Burnout, Finding Balance, a couple of years ago, I interviewed about 200 thought leaders, teachers, also educators, CEOs, athletes, a whole range of different high performers, and 90% of them did not realize they were burning out until it was too late. They didn't realize it. The other 10% was divided into two camps. Some were a little bit aware that something wasn't quite right in their body or, you know, in their mind, but they didn't have any tools or techniques to cope with it, which is where the mindfulness comes in. We'll talk about it in a moment. And the other 5% or so was more like they knew something wasn't quite right and they knew they were, you know, pushing it pretty hard, but they actually didn't stop or they didn't pause and they just kept pushing on anyway. I'll just finish that last little thing. I'll just keep going. I'll just keep going and going and going. And then the end result is burnout. Yeah. So that very first step is self-awareness.
Yeah.
Absolutely, 100%.
Just before we go into, I guess, a few tips there, what is burnout? Like, how do you know when you are burnt out? Because people might not actually realize that they're burnt out, or they might think they're burnt out, but actually not. Like,
yeah, it's a great question. Question to kick off with, actually, to define, let's define what it is, first of all, and also what's the difference between stress and burnout. Yeah, so the WHO in 2019, this is their version of it. And by the way, this is their 11th revision. They've revised the definition 11 times. I think they're getting closer. They're pretty close. I still think it might need a little bit of tweaking and changing. But the WHO defined burnout as chronic workplace stress that has not been successfully managed. So a syndrome conceptualizes chronic workplace stress that has not been successfully managed. I think it's pretty good, but that word workplace is not the only stress that we get. Yes, workplace is a big part of stress, but it can be financial stress. It can be relationship stress. It can be children. It can be a whole range of different things. So they're getting closer. But the three criteria that they, you know, to diagnose burnout is, number one is that absolute sheer exhaustion, absolute total depletion and fatigue, different to just being tired and you have a good night's sleep and you wake up the next day and you feel better. This is the exhaustion that it doesn't matter how much sleep you have, you don't feel any better. So that's number one. Number two is that feeling of detachment. So you're feeling a bit detached from your job, feeling detached or distant from your partner or from your relationships or people around you, and maybe complaining and being a bit more cynical and moaning more than usual. So that detached feeling and that cynicism. And number three is just lack of professional efficacy. Yeah, so something that would normally be easy for you is hard. It's just everything's hard. Everything's difficult. Everything's too much. And making more errors, making more mistakes, just your efficiency and your efficacy. So that's the three criteria to diagnose burnout. And some of us probably here on this call feel some of those things there, you know, from time to time. And that's normal. When it's stress, stress is usually, you know, cumulative over time. And stress, yes, we can still function under stress. And we do need stress. We need some stress to drive us, to motivate us, to help us achieve our goals. But it's about optimizing our stress and knowing how much we need, then being self-aware and, you know, turn off and do all those tools and techniques before it tips into distress. You know, and distress is all those things we talk about, you know, chronic stress, overwhelmed, overstimulated, can't sleep, exhausted. That's stress. But when that accumulates over time, it can lead to burnout or poor mental health. So that's the simple definition. And a lot of people ask, am I burnt out or am I stressed? I mean, if you're still going and you keep going and you have a good night's sleep, you feel better, chances are it's just stress. But when you're burnt out, it's the end result. And there's just no capacity. I'm done. I'm finished. I've got nothing left in the tank.
So you'll know when you're burnt out.
Totally. Yeah. You just can't. You're just basically dysfunctional.
Yeah. You can't get out of bed, that kind of thing. Like,
yeah, won't get out of bed, can't do a simple thing, you can't think, foggy-minded, exhaustion, and then, you know, things like depression or anxiety can start creeping in there. So that's the end result there.
It's really interesting, and that's, yeah, thanks for sharing that, because I always wonder that, like, burning out, like, what is that, and do people, like, think they're burnt out, but they're not? Always wonder that, but that gives a really good explanation and really appreciate that. So how can educators, I guess, learn to maintain energy? So they don't get burnt out.
Another good question. And I think it's more about managing your energy, not just your time. And that's the thing. One of the things with all high performers, is like trying to get them to pause and stop. And that's always hard. Educators are always on, and it's very, contact hours. You're on, you have to be engaged, you're listening to people. There's a lot of emotions, there's a lot of, dynamic conversations going on in through the day. So my encouragement is to renew your energy throughout the day. Don't wait to the end of the evening to be exhausted, and or don't wait to the end of the week to try to recharge, because chances are you got no energy left at all. So my advice for, teachers, educators, also work with many surgeons and doctors, and I'll give the same advice here because they have very busy days, is like grab whatever you can and have micro renewal breaks. So it might be between classes, you just have a little moment and you take a few breaths, or you go outside and sit on a bench for 2 minutes or 3 minutes or something, just to recharge your energy. I teach what's called a 90-second breath break. 90 seconds, literally 90 seconds, to recharge your energy, to deactivate the stress response, to reactivate the prefrontal cortex, your logical analytical mind. But most people don't give themselves permission to have 90 seconds, So my encouragement is take micro renewal breaks throughout the day. I call it punctuation. So punctuate your day instead of like work, 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 crash at the end of the day. It's like work, 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 pause, work, 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 meditate, work, 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 lunch break or morning tea break. And then you're constantly punctuating your day with these little micro renewal breaks, so you're not wiped out at the end of the day. But you
I
have to
love
give
that.
yourself permission to do that. That could be as simple as like going to the bathroom and, washing your hands for, a few minutes and doing some breaths. It could be really simple.
Absolutely. And I really love that because I think that comes down to self-awareness as well, isn't it? But also ownership, like self-awareness that I need to do that, but taking ownership to actually do it. That's the other, being responsible, because no one else can do it. It's up
Most
to
people know it,
us.
but
Exactly.
yeah, most people
100%.
know it, but they don't do it.
You.
I coach a professor, when I got started working with him, I looked at his bio and I thought, oh my God, this guy's got more initials than I've ever seen before. And how am I going to coach this guy? He's far smarter than me. And his wife is the one that actually rang me up. And he's a professor in cardiovascular surgery. He lectures around the world in medical robotics. He's a very clever guy. And in the first session, when I was coaching him, we're talking about, renewal breaks, we're talking about self-care, we're talking about the brain, the neuroscience. And he'd say to me, Mello, I wrote a paper on that. Mello, I wrote a book on that. I lecture on that stuff. I said, fantastic, you know it. It's one thing to know it theoretically, but why are you in the red zone? Because, you're not doing the practices. You're not actually doing the 90-second breath breaks. You're not doing the renewal breaks. And we laughed about it, and he agreed 100%. And it didn't take long for us to implement the practices because he knew the theory. He just wasn't doing it. So, very commonly we know it, but we don't do it. We ignore it.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really interesting. Like someone at that level, like probably the most knowledgeable person out of anyone, and just not doing it. And that's really interesting. And I think like it could be anything. It could be diet. Like most people know what a healthy meal is, isn't it? Like, but we obviously it's okay to indulge every now and then. But if we're eating out or eating junk food a lot, like we all know it's wrong, but we tend to make those decisions. Like, anyway, it's one of those. I totally, yeah, it's interesting what you're saying. And
And I will continue, because often, when I do a lot of workshops and, seminars and things, and often I'm presenting like 101 self-care, like 101. And I'm talking what you just said, diet, exercise, nutrition, sleeping well, meditation, all these things. And we know all these things back to front. I even joke about it. I say, we know all these things, but we don't do these. And think about it this way. Think about it when you get stressed, when you get busy, when you get under the pump, and it might be a busy, report writing time or exam time at school or the end of term, and there's a lot going on. What's the first of those that you let go of? Is it exercise? Ah, I can't be bothered going to the gym tonight. I'm too tired. I'm exhausted. I'm fatigued. Or is it nutrition? Do you just grab takeaway because you can't be bothered cooking, or you're exhausted? So those are the things that we should reclaim. Those are the things, those simple 101 fundamental things, because that's the difference between you staying in the green zone of stress as opposed to the orange and red zone. And they are fundamental, simple things. And as educators, as teachers, we know these things, but we don't actually always practice them.
Absolutely. So I guess, Melo, we talked about like individually, like being self-aware and taking ownership for ourselves, but I always think that we can also help each other. So if you're in a group environment, like a teaching team or like with staff, or it could be a sports team, how can we actually help each other, I guess, to avoid burnout?
Catch it early is the first thing. So we should be opening these conversations early. So creating a safe space where people feel safe to speak up. When I hear the word overwhelm, for example, and many teachers are overwhelmed, and or even if I hear a version of that, it might be like, oh, it's just too much. It's crazy at the moment. I can't keep up. All that sort of language that you hear in around the workplace and probably in the schoolyard, I imagine too, is overwhelmed, overstimulation. When I hear those words or a version of those words, for me, it's an orange flag that that person's not coping. And it's almost a bit too late. And the reason I say this also because in the psychiatric clinics that I do work in, they'll say a version of that. When I say, oh, how did you end up in here? How can I support you? They'll say a version, oh, it was just too much. I couldn't take it anymore. I was overwhelmed. So for me, it's an orange flag that we're almost tipped over the other side to struggling, not coping. So my invitation to all leaders and people in the workplace is to open those conversations earlier. When people are thriving, when people are coping and say, it's a busy time right now. I know, there are lots of opportunities and all these sort of things, and open those conversations then, like, oh, I'm struggling at the moment. How about you? Or it's been a big few weeks. How about you? How are you coping? So my first invitation is to open those conversations early. So when people are struggling, they'll come to you and say, yeah, remember you invited me for that coffee, you invited me for that walk. I'm open for that today. So let's catch it. Let's catch the stress earlier on in the piece.
Interesting. And I guess that, I mean, from a I get from a leadership point of view, that I mean, that's great advice. What do you think about, because I always think teachers can more do together to avoid the workload, and if we not avoid the workload, sorry, manage the workload. If we can share resources, we can share different things together, put things together, that's just going to re reduce the workload and obviously hopefully reduce that stress as well. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And especially when it is a busy period. And I'm sure there's, pooling of resources that we can actually share and support each other. And if someone is, sometimes it's not even just in the workplace, someone might be having a tough week at home. The child might be teething and they're not sleeping and all those sort of things, and they're coming to work and they still have to hold it together. Being aware of that. And that's where opening those conversations and getting those, getting to know people better. So you get to know them. So if you're noticing something in one of your colleagues, for example, they're usually cheery and happy and bubbly, and you notice they're a bit flat, they're a bit, unmotivated, speak to them, talk to them. How can I support you? Is there anything I can do to help you? I'm always here to chat and open those conversations because we can all support each other. And vice versa, if somebody's normally sort of a bit sort of like mellow, excuse the pun, my name, mellow, or pretty grounded person, and you notice they're a bit like anxious, or you notice they're a bit overwhelmed and overstimulated. Same thing. What can I do to support you? So it's that classic, are you okay sort of thing. Ask the question, listen open-mindedly, non-judgmentally, offer some guidance, offer some support, so we can all help each other. And it's about really about opening the conversation and continually. The dialogue should be continual, not only in the tough times.
Absolutely. And oh, sorry, go
Resources.
on,
Yeah, go now. I was just gonna say exactly what you said. Share resources,
man.
please.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think it's important for us to also be aware of how a bit of awareness again about how others, or if you get to know someone, like you'll be able to I guess learn about how they react and their emotions on their faces, and then you can actually I guess have the confidence to know that you can tell that they're not feeling their best. So it's just about, I guess, being in touch with, well, it's a bit of empathy, like understanding how people react, how feel, but knowing other people's emotions as well. I reckon that's a really important skill to have.
Absolutely. And it's easier when you know that person. Look, it's much easier if you know them and you know their character, you know their personality. You've probably got to know them maybe even outside of the work environment, and you might, have a drink or a dinner together. That's easier. But sometimes those more subtle signs from people you don't know quite well, and but you just notice they're a bit different. So, and that's why it's important, even throughout the year, to get to know people more. Get curious, get a bit of curiosity, a bit of empathy towards other people. If there might be young parents in there, get to know them, their family, and just continually opening those dialogues. I have a little game that I play, and I've been doing this ever since COVID, actually. So since COVID started, I made it a point to reach out to 5 to 10 people every single week. So every Monday morning came, I'd actually just reach out 10 people it was during COVID. And it'd be family, friends, colleagues, past workmates, even people that I knew from overseas. And I just made it a point through the whole week. It wouldn't be all day. It'd be like just one day, I'm going to ring up somebody. I'm going to ring up another person, I'll ring up my sister or my brother or my friend or someone in Iceland that I met, when I was traveling in Africa or whatever it was. And I made it a point to do that and just had that proactive approach towards it, because many of us are guilty of like thinking about somebody and I wonder how they're going. But then you get
So
swept
true.
up in work and then you get swept up in life and 3 months pass and you still haven't called. So I've been doing that ever since COVID and I'm still doing that now. Like I even have a little bit of fun with this. I have one category called random contacts and I go into my telephone and look at my telephone and I say, who's Frank P? I don't even know who Frank P is. And I'm going to ring up Frank P and say, hey, how you going, Frank? And it's been great. And I will say, like, I'm from Adelaide originally, and there was a couple of mates in Adelaide during COVID that I did reach out to, and I caught them on the right day. I just caught them. Thanks, Mello, for calling. Really appreciate it. I'm actually struggling at the moment, having a tough day, and I really appreciate it. So you never know, who you're going to call on the day, but having that proactive approach. So even in the workplace, to continue that dialogue in the workplace, get to know people you don't know. There might be some teachers in the periphery that you work with, but you don't really see every day. Make it a point to get to know them. So when you're struggling or they're struggling, you have that connection.
Connect. I was about to say that connection, like, so important. Like, it's one of the things that we need as humans, like that connection. And that, there's so many benefits to it, but just getting to know someone, like, and st your students as well, getting to know them, building connection with them. Because if you're connected to your students, they're going to trust you more and they're going to be more inclined to do basically what you say in terms of teaching and learning. But it's so true for adults, like building connection with each other. And it's, you get to know, like, just maybe what their kids do on the weekend, what they're interested in, and just asking those questions about it instead of how was your day? Good. Like, to be honest, I still do that to my mum when she asks me how my day was. Good. And then move on because I can't be bothered talking. But that connection's so important. And oh, mate, I love it. And I also just want to touch on, like, this is all, I think it's, if you're doing this yourself in the classroom, I'd be modeling it to the students. So they're learning these skills from a young age, like having those little brain breaks, 90-second breathing activities with your students. So why not do it, if you want a break and have that 90 seconds, do it with your kids in the classroom.
Role modeling is the same. As a parent also, I meditate every day, every single day, and I have done for 30 years, and I've not missed one single day for 30 years, believe it or not. And my children, they see that I meditate every day. They see that when I come home from work, I go into, my room and I meditate, or they see I'm meditating in the morning, or they might see my wife doing yoga or something like that. And they see that behavior. We're showing them through our behaviors that this is important to us, and they know that. So I've never forced meditation onto my children at all, but they actually understand that it's important. So role modeling that behavior in the workplace, in the schoolyard, in the as an educator, role modeling that you need a little break. Research says that we can only really optimize our performance and stay optimally and cognitively sharp for periods of around 90 minutes to 2 hours. So after the 90-minute to 2-hour period, our cognition starts waning, we make more mistakes, our decision-making skills are compromised, but most people try to just charge on through or just keep on going. So having a break every 90 minutes or 2 hours is actually a necessity, not a luxury. So if you role model that behavior, to your students and say, hey, time for a 2-minute break, time for a breathing break, or just some sort of thing to actually break that busyness, it's a great asset. And the good thing about some schools, I do know that they are teaching mindfulness practices, and many of them are some great things, but not every school and not every place. And sometimes they lose it as they go into the adult or the higher education and high schools. They might start it out in primary school, but they start losing it later on too.
Yeah, I think I actually agree with that. Like, it can be quite inconsistent. Like, yeah, as you say, some year levels do it at the same school and some don't. But I think when it's that consistency over time, that's when the real impact happens. And I think from what I observed in schools as well, like, to be honest, like, particularly in primary school, a lot of classrooms do those little brain breaks, but they do it for the kids, not for themselves. And like, they don't, I mean, they might participate, but they forget to actually, like, do it themselves. As we said, like, we know, like, because we're doing it for our students, but it's important that we do it for ourselves as well. And one thing I used to do when I was teaching, I used to do push-ups. Like,
Yeah.
go just drop down 20 push-ups. Like, no one was around. I wouldn't do it in front of anyone. But just when I had a little moment, like, that's what I used to do. Like, a bit of physical activity, get that, I don't know, whatever the brain does to get the happy chemicals going, that
Yeah,
exercise
the
produces,
dopamine,
and
the
dopamine, that's
endorphins.
it.
Yeah, the do
Yeah.
yeah, exactly. And that's an example of a renewal break. And that's what I was saying at the when you started the
Yeah.
podcast there, talking about how do we do it. It's like finding the things that renew your energy through the day. And for you, it could be doing 10 push-ups. For someone, it could be doing a meditation. For someone, it could be going for a walk. Or
100%.
someone, it can be just having a chat with somebody, like recharging and energizing by having a meaningful discussion with another teacher, for example. So find all those things that fill up your cup. And use them in your micro breaks, you know, whether it's 10 push-ups, whether it's a walk, whatever it is. And if you've got 10 of those going through the day, so for example, when I teach 90-second breath breaks, I encourage to do at least 5 of those in a day. You know, so when you're feeling a bit rattled, you've got too many things going on in the mind, stop, pause, 90 seconds, reset. Again, you know, towards the end of the day, you do it again, or you might be going between classes. You might be going from one particular subject to another particular subject. Instead of taking that energy into the next classroom, stop, pause, 90 seconds. And I get emails weekly, if not fortnightly, but pretty regularly that people say, oh my God, that 90 second breath break's a game changer. Like it's actually, I don't know how I used to operate before, you know, without it. So, doing those practices and they don't take long. 90 seconds, you know, 5 lots of them instead of picking up your telephone and scrolling or going on the computer and doing something else, just have those little brain breaks and demonstrate the importance of them and you'll have that energy by the end of the day still the same to do exercise and to do all these things which also fill up your cup.
Absolutely. And how does that 90-second breathing activity work, exercise?
Yeah, so very simple. Like it's just, you know, pausing and stopping. And if you're in an environment where you can close your eyes, great. So you might be able to do it on a bench or on a chair somewhere. You can, but you don't have to close your eyes, just empty your gaze. And all you do is actually follow your breath for 90 seconds. So nothing else matters for those 90 seconds but your breath. You may have heard of things like box breathing, you know, where you're counting, you know, you count in, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, you hold for 1, 2, 3, 4, you count out. Find out whatever version of breathing that you like, but I encourage deep diaphragm breathing. So I encourage deeper belly breathing. So when you're breathing in, your stomach expands, your belly expands, your diaphragm drops, and that lets more oxygen into your body and into your brain. And I always encourage just to keep it simple. Just keep it simple. So, you know, doing 90 seconds, following your breath for 90 seconds, and nothing else matters but your breath. And you anchor your mind on your breath for those 90 seconds. You might find it might be in total 15 breaths or something like that, depending on how deep and slow you breathe. But what that does, it takes your mind out of, you know, the busyness and it brings it into your body. And you know, there's a whole range of neuroscience benefits to this. It actually deactivates the sympathetic nervous system, you know, so the fight and flight response, it deactivates it immediately. Because as soon as we close our eyes and do deep breathing, our body, our physiology says, hey, I'm safe. Everything's fine. I'm good. And it goes into what's called the relaxation response. And your body will drop into the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the opposite of the fight and flight response. It's the relaxation response. So, what you're doing is actually teaching yourself to be having periods of on. And this goes back to your original question, being on all the time. You have periods of on. You do a little breath break, you turn off for a moment. And then your periods of on, you do another little breath break, you're off for a moment. So in your day, you're having this perfect balance of parasympathetic and sympathetic activity. So you're finding balance in your day, not, you know, at the end of the year, you finally get your holidays. That's not balance. You know, a lot of people say, oh, I'll just work hard all term and then I'll get my holidays and I'll recharge. That's not balance. And chances are those first 3 or 5 days of your holidays, you're exhausted and you fall sick because your nervous system shot. So let's find balance in our day by doing these 90-second breath breaks. In fact, I actually, when I am teaching meditation and I teach it a lot, I always teach the 90-second breath break first because I'd rather that you did 5 lots of 90-second breath breaks as opposed to a longer 10-minute practice when you're starting out. Because what you're doing is you're training your physiology, your body, to relax the mind and to calm the mind. And then you have that ability to switch that on at will. The more you do that, the more the body recognizes, okay, I'm doing that. And you can even do that in the classroom, standing up. You could be, you know, setting the students a little topic to do, and you can do some breathing. and just slowly breathe and just find your place. You don't close your eyes, of course, but you're doing that breathing and you're resetting. So you can have these micro resets the more you train your physiology to affect your psychology.
No, it's, and really, thanks for that.
Yeah.
It's really well explained and makes a lot of sense. And I like that balance of like those on, like building up. And then I mean, we're only on audio here, but sort of like lifting,
Yeah.
like our hands up towards our heads. And then, but like that breathing can bring us back down to a more neutral position. And then we might go up, 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 up. But that another lot of 90-second breathing can bring us back down to a more balanced state. And, I guess that's why you're cool. That's why you've got the balance in the title of your book. It's
Yeah, beating burnout, finding balance. And also, like on that note, a lot of teachers that I do know and work with, they fall asleep okay because they're exhausted at the end of their day and they're thinking a lot. And there's a lot of cognition going through the day of in a teaching day. But then they wake up at 2 in the morning or 3 in the morning and they're thinking and they're problem solving and planning. So that goes back to that same thing. Very often we're wound up all day. We just stay wound up all day, all day, all day, all day, all day. And then we crash at night because we're tired. But then our mind gets busy in the middle of the night. So having these micro breaks, they're like little uploads. So in the daytime, so you're downloading the last few hours, and then you're downloading the last few hours again. So when you go to bed at night, you don't have to do this massive download of your whole day. You've done these little downloads through the day. So that's why it's really great for sleep. But most of my clients that work with me say, "Oh my God, Mello, I've had the best night's sleep. I haven't slept like that for like decades. I haven't slept like that for 8 hours all in a row for years and years," because they're doing these practices throughout the day.
Brilliant. I just want to change, like, I've just got a couple more questions, but
Sure.
I just want you to explain. So, excuse me, workplace cultures, like schools can be really interesting places. Like,
Yeah.
I better be careful what I say, but quite often they can be, the staff room can be very toxic.
Yeah.
You've got people who come in and it's just, I understand it because they might have had a bad experience, I know, with some students during the day
Yeah.
before lunch, and they want to, I guess, what's the word, like express how they're feeling,
Yeah.
unload,
Yeah.
and but they can be quite negative, like towards each other. How does that, I guess, that whole, I don't know if it's a cultural thing, but how does that impact other people, or like, and burning out if you're in an environment that's so negative? And I guess I'm not sure if it's to do with burnout, but it might just be one of those
It's a mindset thing.
mindset thing where, oh,
Yeah.
here we go again. Like, and I
Yeah.
actually, when I was teaching, back years ago, I actually had to take myself out of certain situations, like, because
Yeah.
I just didn't want to be drawn into, I don't know, negative conversations, like teachers talking behind each other's back. And it used to get to
Yeah.
me, it used to bother me. And I don't know, I just always used to, well, or brought up and just used to think, you, I know, talk positively about people. And if you got an issue, you will, I don't know, you sort of do it the right way rather
Yeah.
than like bitch and moan about it. So, can you talk to that?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And I'll share a story with you actually. That's I think we'll answer this in a way, and then I'll share some other things. So I used to work in schools myself for many years in another lifetime, not as a teacher, but I actually used to I'm a horticulturalist by background. So I used to work in some private schools, and I was the horticulturalist, gardener, groundsman type thing there. And I worked for 9 years in a school. And I always noticed, the happy teachers, the good ones, the positive ones, and the ones that the kids loved. And also noticed the toxic ones and the negative ones and the complaining ones and the moaning ones. And some of them are institutionalized. And yes, we have to be careful what we say here, but I'm going to be brutally honest here. And I remember I was actually leaving the school and going on this big adventure to cycle around the world on my mountain bike. So I had this grand plan to cycle around the world for 2.5 years or 3 years to go around the world. And the days before I left, talking to the teachers, and they were all very excited to me. I'll never forget this. There was two teachers that were sitting in the yard there, and they were complaining and moaning about the kids and the subject. And they were complaining about the same things that I overheard them saying over and over and over again. Two teachers, same two, sitting in the same spot, complaining about the same things. And then I went and cycled around the world. I did. I went around the planet. It took me 2.5 years, 3 years, ended up traveling for longer. I came back 4 years later. 4 years later, I needed a job quickly, and I went back to the school and I said, "Do you have some part-time work for me?" "Sure, no problem." They gave me a job, which was fantastic. Went back and landed in the same place again. And I kid you not, this is no lie. Those two teachers were still pretty much standing in the same spot 4 years later, complaining about the same issues. I thought, "Oh my God, I have to get out of here. I can't stay here myself." I didn't last long. I stayed about 3 months. I thought, "I've seen the whole planet now. I can't go back to this." But Man, they get quite institutionalized and that sort of toxic culture there. So this is a mindset. This is a mindset shift. And we all know great teachers, and many of you out there listening are probably great teachers too, I'm sure. And teachers have an amazing role. And so that mindset shift that I'd share is like, and I remember teachers from my primary school that influenced me. I remember teachers that, said things. I can even re recall an exact quote that a grade three teacher taught me that influenced the way I think. Like, we have this as teachers, you have this absolute privilege, to be honest, to educate children, to shape children, especially in those younger years. You're shaping values, you're shaping virtues. And I think it's a privilege to be in that position and remember that why you're actually there to start with. And some teachers I do know, they love their work initially and they want to change the world and they want to educate the kids, but then they just get caught in the system, and the system's not always great, and there's a lot of, institutionalized things that go on in there, and they start complaining about things that, they're quite minor usually. So my encouragement is, like, let's shift that mindset. Like, I'm here, I'm in a position where I can actually make an impact to the world. I'm here, I can actually influence and, give some great values and virtues and lessons to these students. I'm actually in a place of privilege. And you know all about gratitude. You're the guy that talks about this, being grateful to be in that position, being grateful that I'm in this position and not get caught up in the toxic culture and the toxicity. And I know it was a long-winded answer to that thing, but sometimes we forget that. It's the same as, it's ironic that teachers, carers, doctors, medical professionals have the highest rates of burnout. It's kind of ironic. We care, so much. We go into these industries because we care about kids, we care about people, we care about humanity, but sometimes the system or the work just sort of carries us away and we forget about that. So it's almost go back to the why. Why did I start this profession in the first place? Why do I love doing what I do? And, reclaim that, really important.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. And now, thanks for sharing those insights and that story about coming back 4 years later. God, I can just picture that actually. Like, just one more thing. I'm really interested because I think we can train our brains to get through challenges. So there's this thing called misogy. I think it's pronounced it misogy, where you do, where you set yourself challenges. It could be 1 a year, I don't know, 2 a year, where it's something where you're not going to necessarily die, but it's going to be a challenge that you might do it or you might not. And I got that off a guy called Jesse Itzler, who is an American guy, and he talks about it a lot. And I started to do that over the last, I started last year. And one of the ones that I did was I go to a gym called The Yard, which is like quite high intense training. And my goal was to do, I think there's 7 sessions they offer a day. And my goal was to do every session for the week, which ended up being up about 30 odd, 36 or 7 sessions. And I set myself, I'm going to do that. That's going to be physically hard. It's going to train my brain to do hard things. I might not make it, but I did. And like just that accomplishment, like train my mind to know I can do hard things. Now it doesn't have to be physical. I did a 3-day water fast early this year, and that might not sound too bad, but like it was mentally challenging that one, like to do a water fast without eating because I don't mind a bit of food, but just what do you think about those challenges? I know that you've cycled around the world like 330,000 Ks. I guess that would have, was that the kind of mindset that you had as well?
I do like to challenge myself. Yeah, so I cycled around the world about 30,000 kilometers across 5 continents, and mostly lived with indigenous peoples and stayed in monasteries and temples. That was an amazing experience that's shaped who I am today. But I'm similar to you in a way that I do like to set myself little challenges, and they could be physical, they could be mental, they could be some sort of things. I call it like seek the uncomfortable. You do something that makes you a little bit uncomfortable. And all of these things that you do daily, they make it less uncomfortable. You get more comfortable with them over time. So 1 year, for example, I did set myself the challenge of swimming in the sea every single day. So 365 days of the year. And it was great when it was January here in Australia because it was like summer. This is fun. This is easy. And then came, July, August, September. And I was like, oh my God, this ocean's freezing. But I still did it anyway. And I
You're on.
accomplished it. So in those tough days and in those tough times, that's what shapes us. That's what actually, so putting yourself in a bit of, a tough situation. And these are what shapes, this is what builds our resilience. That's what builds our mental endurance. I also, like I said, I meditate every single day. And there's some days that I don't feel like it. I think, oh, what do I need to meditate today? I feel pretty good. I feel like, hey, but I do it anyway because it's a
100%.
discipline. And I know that I'm meditating today because maybe tomorrow's going to be tough, or maybe something's going to happen this afternoon that I need my resilience, I need my strength, I need my endurance to actually to get through that. So I totally agree with you. Like, find things that challenge, because very often we live in this very comfortable world, and anything that sort of goes out of the ordinary decks us, and it's just too much. And it's like, so putting yourself in these little situations, building your mental endurance, building your physical endurance if you want to do something physical. But we have to do them, but we have to actually implement them. So I encourage everybody out there, think about it. It might just be, to train your mind to get stronger. Many people train their body, but not many people train their mind. And I learned early on that actually training your mind is as important, if not more important, because if you're running a marathon, for example, and you're on those last challenging kilometers, it's your mind that's going to get you through
Definitely.
usually. So yeah, set yourself a little
100%.
challenge. What did you call it? Manoji, is it? Did you say
I
that?
think it's called Misoji,
Misoji.
Mysogi or something. It's a Japanese term.
I love it. Yeah,
Soji, yeah.
I love it. But yeah, set yourself little challenges. It could just be a small thing. Could just be, to meditate every day, or could be 10 push-ups. One of my funny challenges this year is I don't really like push-ups very much. And so this year, my challenge, I start at the beginning of the year, is I just have to do whatever the date of the, so for example, today's the 27th of May. So when we're recording this, is the 27th. So I have to do 27 push-ups. Tomorrow I have to do 28 push-ups. Next day, 30 push-ups. It's great when it comes one again. So I just do one push-up and two push-ups. So whatever the day of the month, the first day of the month, I do one. I just
Love
did
it.
it for a bit of like consistency. So I usually have a word per year. My word for this year is consistency. That's my
Brilliant.
word. Last year it might have been growth, for example. The other year it might have been something. So with that word comes intention. So my intention this year is to be consistent. So I'm being consistent with my push-ups. I do one, then I do two, then I do three. Today I do 27, and it just gives me something a framework to sort of sit by, and gives me that discipline. So I love it. It's a great concept.
Brilliant. I totally agree, and I think it's good to challenge ourselves. And everyone's different. Like whatever challenges us. Like if you know that it's going to stretch you, like have a go. Like and just commit to it. And I think consistency is the key. Like just being consistent in what you're doing. Like I think it's meditation. Like the more consistent you get, the more you'll get out of it, and the better you'll feel. And same with exercise. You go and what to the gym once, and then don't go again for another month. It's not going to have any impact. But it's just like training, and I go to the gym to train my mind, like to do hard things. And yes, it's good physically, but the purpose is to do something mentally challenging at the start of the day, so set yourself up for the day that different things are going to come up to you, and you've trained your mind to handle challenging things.
And for the teachers there that don't practice meditation, never have, or maybe they've sort of dabbled with it, that could be a discipline to actually do. You could say every night when I get home, when I finish my work day, for example, and some teachers there, I imagine, have not only children at school, they have children at home too. And when they get home, it's another work shift. So it could be when I finish my work day, I stop in the driveway and I do 5 minutes of meditation and before I go into the house. Or it could be when I finish my evening chores and dinner and everything, kids go to bed, I'm going to do 10 minutes of meditation. So find a discipline that will stick, and that's mindfulness training. And then you take that discipline off the mat, so to speak. So you're actually doing these 10 minutes of practice or 5 minutes of practice, and then you'll notice through the day you've got more resilience. You'll notice through the day you've got more focus. You'll notice through the day. So it has a flow-on effect to everything you do in life.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Mate, this has been a brilliant conversation. We've probably gone over a little bit longer than we normally would, but I've just got so many questions, and those answers were brilliant, mate. I really appreciate your time and so many takeaways that I know that personally I took away from today, but I know that other listeners will take away as well. And I guess it's good to hear these ideas, but it's actually best to do it. So try some of these things. Like ideas are great, but they're useless unless we actually take action. So plenty to take action on. And Mello, I really appreciate your time. And actually, before we go, where can they people find you?
Sure, definitely. Best place is probably my website, Mello Calarco, MelloCalarco.com. I'm sure you put that in the show notes there. Actually, if you jump on there, I've got some free meditations on there. Also a free sample chapter of my book, which is chapter one. Guess what the title of that chapter is? It's all about self-awareness. So the number one chapter is self-awareness, and it talks about a situation where I had to meditate for 12 hours in a storm to survive, a pretty nice, actually based in South Australia. So jump jump onto the website, feel free to connect me on LinkedIn also. LinkedIn is also another good place. I share some content and things like that. So thanks for having me, Ash. I really appreciate it.
Brilliant, man. Thank you. Thanks, Mel. I really appreciate it, mate.